How strong is the West's resolve when it comes to Ukraine? A steady diet of diplomacy so far failing to lift the uncertainty over Vladimir Putin's true intentions when it comes to those 100,000 troops amassed at the border after Kiev, Germany's new foreign minister in Moscow this Tuesday. What does Annalena Baerbock bring to the table? She's a Green and a coalition led by the Social Democrats. How far will new Chancellor Olaf Scholz push? Olaf Scholz, who was hosting the NATO Secretary General this Tuesday. Ultimately, it's his decision whether to greenlight the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline that bypasses Ukraine and links Russia to Western Europe via, well, his predecessor's home constituency on the Baltic Sea. How hard will Germany and the rest of the EU come down in case of another Russian invasion? It depends in large part on Washington's resolve. Antony Blinken, now to meet Sergei Lavrov again. It'll be on Friday in Geneva. The U.S. Secretary of State has an ace in the hole, you might say, the ability to freeze international transaction in dollars for Russia. Would the U.S. Treasury go so far as to freeze Moscow out of the system? What contingencies has the Kremlin made in case of that financial nuclear option? In the end, can Vladimir Putin bypass the Yankee dollar? One of the questions we'll be asking in the France 24 debate when we look at what would happen if Russia did in fact invade. Joining us from Berlin is Julia Friedrich, research fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
From London, Bill Browder, CEO of Hermitage Capital, head of the Global Magnitsky Justice Campaign, the author of the best-selling book Red Notice, a true story of high finance murder and one man's fight for justice. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
From Washington, Melinda Herring, deputy director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And from Kiev, France 24 correspondent Gulliver Cragg. How are things, Gulliver?
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
The France 24 debate, where you can always join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. They say diplomacy is the art of the possible. Earlier, Annalena Baerbock going to Moscow as part of efforts to bring the Kremlin back to direct talks with Kiev, so the so-called Normandy format, in other words, bringing in German and French mediators. It was part of, you might say, a diplomatic flurry that's still going on after last week. And Brian Quinn has more.
Seeking to ease tensions as Europe braces for the possibility of war in Ukraine, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock met Tuesday with her Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, both sides stressing the importance of good relations, but a dark cloud hung over the talks.
More than 100,000 Russian soldiers with tanks and guns have gathered near Ukraine in recent weeks, for no understandable reason. And it's hard not to see this as a threat.
Berlin wants to revive the so-called Normandy format for Russia-Ukraine peace talks, in which both Germany and France take part. Russia, though, says it won't even consider new negotiations until the West responds to its demands, including a guarantee that Ukraine and other former Eastern Bloc nations will never join the NATO military alliance. A key piece of leverage in the standoff remains the recently completed, but not yet operational, Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. Berlin has previously resisted a push by Washington to include the pipeline in potential sanctions against Russia. Baerbock, though, now says Germany is prepared to pay a heavy economic price, putting Nord Stream 2 on the table, much to Moscow's chagrin.
Nord Stream 2 is the largest commercial project in the last decade aimed at ensuring German and European energy security. We reminded our German colleagues that attempts to politicize this project would be counterproductive.
Tuesday's meeting came as Russian troops arrived for military drills in Belarus, which borders both Russia and Ukraine, further adding to fears of an imminent incursion.
So Julia Friedrich, the whole of Europe and the whole world really watching this visit because you've got a new government in Germany. And Germany is the country, particularly under the Social Democrats, of Ostpolitik, of detente with Russia? Is there the sense that they're serious when it comes to putting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline on ice for a long time, perhaps?
Well, I think that Baerbock's visit in Moscow today went slightly better than expected. Expectations were very, very low. And we saw that the tone was slightly, well, less icy, let's say, than expected. And we also had a very positive sign today because both Foreign Minister Baerbock as well as Chancellor Scholz in Berlin, who was speaking to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, have affirmed that everything is on the table, including the pipeline Nord Stream 2. This comes after days of speculations when other Social Democrats had denied that this was an option. So we can say that today was good in the sense that this message was sent. It was sent by both the Foreign Office and the Chancellery and by both parties in the coalition that don't necessarily see eye to eye on this.
Yeah, because you'd had the Social Democrat Defense Minister, Christine Lambrecht, quoted as saying that the pipeline shouldn't be dragged into this conflict. It has, in effect, is what you're saying.
Well, yes. I mean, Germany has been remarkably consistent in claiming that this project was a purely economic project. But with Scholz today affirming that it is, in fact, or that everything is on the table, this is a sign that he's also trying to silence also the other voices in his party that that want to view this project as purely an economic one.
Yes. Melinda Herring, before I ask you about you could call it the breaking news out of Washington with the announcement that Antony Blinken will be meeting his Russian counterpart at the end of the week again, your reaction to that visit by Annalena Baerbock to Moscow?
So I don't think it's really a big deal. The foreign minister was in Kiev yesterday. She's in Moscow today. And I think that her message was fabulous. She was very strong. She said that Ukraine has to maintain its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And she said that if Russia invades Ukraine again, that Nord Stream 2 is not going forward. So I think today was a win.
It was a win. And now what do you make of this announcement we've had that more dates have been tacked on to Antony Blinken's visit to Europe? He was supposed to just go to Berlin, or at least that was announced. Now he's first going to Kiev and then Geneva for that meeting with Sergei Lavrov.
So it's a little weird. Last week, we had three big meetings, and the Russians said that nothing was achieved. And they were very, very negative. And they said, we don't want to meet anymore until we see those security guarantees come back. And the U.S. has not responded to those security guarantees. But they've also, Moscow keeps pressuring us to meet and meet and meet. Now, I think it's a little, I'm nervous because the U.S. has not demanded de-escalation in place of these meetings. And I think that was a real mistake. But it's good that Washington and Moscow are talking, but I think last week showed the limitations of diplomacy. We have reached a point where both sides fundamentally disagree about NATO membership, and there's no way to square that circle.
No way to square that circle, but wait, are you saying you've come around and that you're now okay with the U.S. Secretary of State meeting Sergei Lavrov?
I think he has to. I think that the U.S. made a mistake and gave away some leverage. Last week, they did three big meetings, and they did not demand de-escalation before those meetings. Why didn't they? I think a lot of people have patted Washington on the back and President Biden for being strong and tough. He put down three major consequences if Russia invades again. He said, you will see the biggest, meanest, nasty package of sanctions that you've ever seen. You will see more defensive material in Ukraine, and you'll see more NATO troops, right? Those were the three conditions. The big question is, has that deterred Putin? And I think the answer is no. And the U.S. has only done one of those three so far. It's sent more defensive material. But why is it the Biden administration pushing NATO to move more troops into Poland and Romania now? It's not too late to do that.
Bill Browder, last week we were speculating, was Vladimir Putin really intent on an invasion? Was this attention-seeking behavior? He wants the U.S. to sit down and renegotiate the architectural security of Europe. What do you make of the timing of what's going on? First, the troop buildup, and now the diplomatic flurry.
Well, I would say this whole thing, it has nothing to do with Ukraine and has everything to do with Vladimir Putin's domestic position. He does this type of thing whenever he's starting to be unpopular domestically. In 2014, he took Crimea as a way of boosting his popularity. Russia is going through an economic calamity brought on by COVID. A lot of people also dying from COVID. He's not as popular as he was before, and he needs to have a war, an enemy, a situation. And I should just remind everybody listening that Russia has been at war with Ukraine since 2014. Russia took Crimea. Russia, they call them Russian-backed separatists. This is Russia who took eastern Ukraine. And so all we're talking about is parking more Russian troops at the border. In my opinion, this is all part of a big provocation exercise for a domestic audience in Russia. And we are giving Putin exactly what he wants, which is a seat at the top table where everybody is going and kissing the ring and begging him not to be a bad guy. The only thing that works with Vladimir Putin is hardcore consequences.
Wait a second. You're saying that Annalena Baerbock going to Moscow is kissing the ring?
Exactly. What's the purpose of going to Moscow? We already know what their demands are. They're unreasonable demands. We should not be, we should say no, as we have said, but to go there and beg them not to be bad, it doesn't achieve anything other than so he can go on television and say, look, I had the German foreign minister here begging us for something. And that is this entire exercise. He's now become the center of the world by parking 100,000 troops at the border. And what we should say very clearly is what we have said, which is there'll be terrible, terrible things that will happen to you if you do that. And just leave it at that. What is there to talk about?
All right. Those terrible things, the nuclear option, if you will, pardon the pun, in those terrible things would be to cut Russia off from the world banking system. U.S. officials quick to deny with a published report that the European Union and they have agreed to ease off shutting Russia out of the so-called SWIFT international financial transaction system. German Business Daily Handelsblatt reporting the West is instead preparing to target Russia's largest banks with the fear that a blanket SWIFT ban would encourage Moscow into building an alternative payments system. Since the 2014 annexation, though, of Crimea and the sanctions that followed, Russia's already been making efforts to, as they call it, de-dollarize its economy. You can see by this graph the increase in foreign reserves, gold reserves that are up sharply. Bill Browder, this talk of kicking Russia out of SWIFT, is it serious?
I'm not sure how serious it is, but to the extent that it is serious, that's a real devastating blow, or would be a devastating blow to Russia if it were to happen. When this was done to Iran, it basically brought the Iranian economy back to the dark ages. And that is what ended up bringing the Iranians to negotiate after years and years of begging them to negotiate. You can only negotiate when you're in a position of strength, when you have leverage. And cutting Russia off SWIFT would be that. I was very heartened to read it, and I'm disheartened to read that's not a real threat. But I don't think anyone really knows what the real threats are or what they aren't right now. Everybody is scrambling.
If it did happen, would Putin have enough reserves to be able to pivot away from the dollar?
Yeah. No. I mean, it's all about In order to pivot away from the dollar, you have to find other. You have to effectively have a trusted trading system. Nobody trusts the ruble. It's not like you can all of a sudden have everybody want to keep their money in rubles, trade with Russia in rubles, etc. And so they would be absolutely in a desperate situation if they were cut off from SWIFT. No question about it.
Julia Friedrich.
We can only hope so.
We can only hope so, you're saying. saying. Yeah. How serious are the sanctions that are being prepared?
Please?
Go ahead, Gulliver Craig.
I don't know if people can hear me. I just would like to ask Bill Browder, because this is not my area of expertise. Europe gets 40% of its gas imports from Russia. Is it not going to be a huge problem for all these European countries to pay for those gas imports if Russia is cut off from the SWIFT system?
There's no question that it would complicate everything if Russia were cut off from the SWIFT system.
And so they won't do it, no?
I mean, you know, putting SWIFT aside for a second, we had a major Cold War with the Soviet Union for decades, and the gas supplies flowed very safely. I mean, from a Russian standpoint, if for some reason they weren't selling the gas anymore, their economy would completely stop. That's all they have in terms of exports is gas and oil. I mean, it surely would complicate everything if they were cut off from SWIFT, but at the same time, it would complicate everything if all of a sudden there was a major land attack in Ukraine. And so there's no good outcome in a situation like this. And so it's not like saying, well, we shouldn't politicize.
But it's like another means of paying for the gas could be found if Russia was cut off from the SWIFT system. It's not like we're saying that if Russia is cut off from the SWIFT system, then that means European countries would have to stop importing all of this gas.
Well, so the way that you would cut off Russia from the SWIFT system is to say that anybody who tried to trade in dollars with Russia would be sanctioned for violating violating U.S. sanctions or EU or UN sanctions or whatever we decide to call them. At the end of the day, if an exemption was made for Russian gas, an exemption could be made for Russian gas.
Let me bring in Melinda Haring on
this.
But
I think there's a bigger problem. SWIFT is not even a consideration. As far as what we're hearing in Washington, Washington has told Moscow what it will do. It has described this mean, nasty package of sanctions, but SWIFT is not part of it. Right now, the sanctions on Russia on a 10-point scale are at a 2 or 3. What we're looking at if Russia invades Ukraine again is more like an 8 or 9, but it does not include SWIFT. But Russia knows what it faces. I don't know that Bill's right. I think Russia has priced in what this would cost. They have $630 billion in international reserves. That's about 38% of their GDP. They know what this would cost, and I don't think that they're very scared by our sanctions. That's my great fear.
Not very scared by the sanctions. Of course, there's rhetoric, what we hear in front of the cameras. Let's listen, for instance, to the Russian foreign secretary.
We don't construct our policy under the principle of what happens if. That sounds more like our Western colleagues who threaten sanctions against the Russian Federation at the drop of a hat practically every day.
But Melinda Haring, we do know that Russia, to a certain degree, is wary. It's wary. We'll recall, for instance, that this whole troop buildup began after the Ukrainian military started using drones. So there is this feeling that Russia was caught off guard. Is it purely about domestic politics, the way Bill Browder put it?
No, I see five. I see a lot of different reasons why Putin might go in this time. One, I agree with Bill a little bit. Putin is old and he's an aging autocrat and he cares about his legacy. So when you look at who he compares himself to and who he wants to be like, he talks about Stalin and Ivan the Great. And you're a great leader in Russia if you take a big swath of land. So that's one argument in favor of going in this time. Another argument in favor is that there's never been a better time. Vladimir Putin looks at the world and he sees weakness everywhere. He sees Biden's numbers plunging. He sees Zelensky's numbers plunging. He sees oil and gas prices are up. He had a great year in 2021. There's no real leader in Europe. There's never been a better time for him to go in. There's also been increasing bellicose rhetoric in Moscow since July. Putin wrote a long-winded historical essay about how Ukraine is not a real country. Its leaders are illegitimate. And by the way, Russia's lands sit on Ukraine. This is our land. Now it looks looks like a declaration of war. And then the fourth reason I think that he's considering it this time for real is he's frustrated with Volodymyr Zelensky. He couldn't get a deal. He thought he'd be able to get a deal. And Zelensky won't stop talking about NATO. And he sees growing support for NATO. It's at 58% in Ukraine today. So, and he also is sitting on a lot of international reserves. So I think when he looks at the map, there's never been a better time. But is he going to go in? He's aware that sanctions do bite. I don't think they bite as much as the West would like them to bite. Our economists say they bite between 2 and 3% of GDP. They can factor it in given the international reserves they have. But there may be other ways to achieve his aims without a full-scale invasion. So I think that's what Moscow is really looking at now, is how do we get what we want without triggering these big sanctions and causing the most chaos and dislocation in Ukraine and in Europe.
So, Gulliver Cragg, we had, where you are, that cyber attack at the end of last week that targeted Ukrainian government institutions. Now these reports that the Russians...
We still don't know.
We
still don't know what the real extent of that cyber attack was, and how much damage they did and how much malware they put in. That's something that Ukrainians are very worried about, I think.
They're worried about that. And you see the report out this Monday that the Russians scaling back their staff at the embassy in Kiev. What's the mood where you are?
I mean, the Ukrainian government said that they were not informed by the Russian side about this scaling back of staff at the embassy. On the other hand, it was reported in the New York Times that these staff left by bus. They clearly weren't trying to hide. One might think that this is all part of Russia's bluff, that they really, really want everyone to believe that they're planning to attack. And a lot of people in Ukraine still think that it's obviously in Putin's interest to take this bluff as far as he possibly can. Is it really in his interest to actually launch an air raid on Kiev or an incursion into eastern Ukraine? Maybe, but certainly there are a lot of Ukrainians you still run into who just don't believe it. Perhaps people are refusing to believe it. Perhaps they're hiding their head in the sand. I don't know. But certainly the other aspect of the debate, which would kind of lead one to come down more on the side of probably he is going to do something, is the debate about, is this really about Ukraine, or is it about NATO, or is it, as Bill Browder was saying, about Russian public opinion? I doubt the theory about Russian public opinion, really, because I think that opinion polls in Russia show that Russians don't really have an appetite for another foreign war. It's not the same atmosphere as in 2014 with Crimea. And then there's the question of, is this really about Europe's... I wanted to say, if Vladimir Putin doesn't get what he has explicitly stated he wants, I mean, if he doesn't get any withdrawal of NATO troops from Poland or the Baltic states and basically has to go back to the Russian people saying, well, no, they didn't give us anything that we asked for. I mean, how's that going to play out with Russian public opinion? That doesn't really make sense to me. And also, certainly, the viewed from Ukraine, all the people saying this is about NATO, this is about Europe's security architecture, it's not really about Ukraine. Ukrainians are quite skeptical about that. Ukrainians think it's perhaps more about Ukraine than what the rest of the world thinks, pointing to that essay that Vladimir Putin wrote about Ukrainians and Russians being one people, pointing as Melinda Herring saying to Vladimir Putin's eye on his legacy and that he would like to be the guy who won back control of Ukraine. And he's realized he can't do it by getting the Ukrainians to vote for a pro-Russian candidate. And so he's thinking he's going to have to do it by some kind of force. And if you see things that way, then there are certainly reasons to be nervous.
And to Melinda's point that Zelensky has stayed on message talking about joining NATO all the time, further annoying Vladimir Putin?
Well, I mean, I don't really know whether or not that is what's annoying Vladimir Putin, but it depends whether or not you believe that Vladimir Putin is somehow convinced that Ukraine might join NATO or that there might be offensive NATO weapons deployed in Ukraine. I think there is quite strong reason to think that all that is just a pretext, a straw man, actually, as the UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace wrote in a piece that I read today that was published on the UK government website. He says all this stuff about NATO and Russia security is a straw man. The real target is Ukraine. That, I mean, among all the column inches arguing different points very cogently, but really quite incompatible points with each other, I think that the points made by Ben Wallace saying that really this is about Ukraine, that they resonate with Ukrainians pretty strongly. And of course, the UK has now committed to arming Ukraine. At the moment, the United Kingdom's rather more in Ukrainians' good books than Germany or the United States,
Let's talk about that.
Sanctions, but Ukrainians aren't really sure.
Talk about that. The UK Defense Secretary Ben Wallace announcing Monday an undisclosed number of military advisors are being sent to train troops there in the use of high-tech equipment and light anti-armor defensive weapons systems. The Kremlin has also been invited to go to London for talks. Let's see how that went down.
This is all in line with our concerns in connection with the seizure of Ukrainian territory by various suppliers of weapons, which are not only defensive, but also offensive. This is extremely dangerous and does not help reduce tensions.
So, Julia Friedrich, we knew before the German foreign minister went to Moscow today, there wouldn't be any German arm exports or German military advisors going to Ukraine. That's a policy that the Germans have. Your thoughts on the British?
I think the British are trying to send a sign that they are serious in backing Ukraine against Russia, and the British are probably also aware that the Germans will not budge on this. And in this vein, also the EU is very unlikely to budge on any further supply of defensive weapons. Annalena Baerbock was also asked about this when she was in Kyiv, and then argued that it was within Germany's historic responsibility for peace to not deliver weapons, which in Ukraine didn't fly very well because it was one of the countries that suffered most under Nazi occupation. So we see that Germany is kind of feels backed into a corner regarding this policy, but it's very unlikely to change. And I wanted to add to what was said before about whether it was about Ukraine, about NATO, or about sort of a domestic calculus, and say that it might also just be a way of hitting three birds with one stone, really, and getting sort of advancing on all of these agendas that Putin clearly has.
All right. So, Bill Browder, you're in London. The UK sending military advisors. If the British wanted to hit Moscow hard, wouldn't they sanction, I don't know, the owner of Chelsea Football Club, Roman Abramovich, one of these oligarchs who owns in this case a big football club, but there are plenty of whom park their money in London.
Well, so we were talking about the three big things on the table: economic sanctions, military equipment, and more NATO members. But the one thing which hasn't been discussed, which I think is the most effective tool, is just what you said. To put it in some context, again, coming back to what Vladimir Putin is all about, Vladimir Putin is first and foremost a kleptocrat. He's stolen an enormous amount of money since he's been in power. I estimate $200 billion. He doesn't keep any of that money in his own name. He puts that money in the name of oligarch trustees, a lot of these oligarchs you've heard about. And all of these oligarchs keep that money in banks in the West. And so Putin's big Achilles heel, and his personal Achilles heel, is this money, his money, the money held by oligarchs. And a very, very powerful way of affecting his behavior should be done preemptively as opposed to after he invades, is to start sanctioning Russian oligarchs for the buildup of troops on the border.
How would you go about it?
There's a list of oligarchs who are effectively trustees of Putin. It's been compiled by members of the Russian opposition, by Alexei Navalny's organization, various other people. And if there's 40 people on the list, start with the first five, saying unless you move your troops back, the first five are going to be saying we're going to freeze their assets worldwide, EU, US, UK, Canada, in the next 24 hours. And then we'll do another week, another five. And let's see how quickly Vladimir Putin keeps all of his troops on the border.
Yeah, this culture of oligarchs, it's all the former Soviet states, Bill. We saw it last week when we were watching those unprecedented events that unfolded in Kazakhstan. The same holds true, by the way, for Ukraine. After all, the former president, Petro Poroshenko, was an oligarch.
Well, there's definitely a whole sort of trend of oligarch kleptocracy and oligarch capitalism in all of these places. But Russia is by far, you know, the leader in this. The number, the amount of money from Russia, the amount of money stolen from the state, the amount of money in the hands of the oligarchs, the amount of government officials partnered with the oligarchs, and the amount of money offshore, it's really in a sort of class by itself. And it is a huge, huge opportunity for the West in this type of situation, and a huge Achilles heel for Putin. And it's remarkable to me that that is not one of the things on the menu, because that's a way that it takes everybody else out of the picture. You don't have to worry about gas. You don't have to worry about Russian citizens being affected by this. You don't have to worry about anything other than a small number of people who are effectively causing the trouble by looking after Putin's money.
Yeah, when another oligarch, Melinda Herring, owned the Brooklyn Nets, was that a problem?
I'm not sorry. I'm not completely familiar with that. I'm so sorry.
But I mean, this issue of targeting those close to Vladimir Putin, is that something being discussed in Washington?
Yes, it is. It's in a Senate bill right now that's been proposed, and it made Moscow furious. So Vladimir Putin is one of the targets, as well as some other Russian oligarchs. So I think it's something that's being discussed. You know, I think all options are on the table. I think Washington is really serious and really freaked out by the intelligence we've seen. I think that there's one thing we haven't talked about. The mood in Washington is very anxious. In Kiev, it's very different. And we have a gentleman named Vladislav Davidson on the ground there, a journalist. And he says that people don't want to talk about it, and that they want to go about their merry way, or they feel very fatalistic, that if it happens, it was meant to be. So, and then Europe feels very different as well. So there's different perceptions of the threat
right,
of this
yeah.
Russian escalation right now.
Gulliver Craig?
I was just saying, yeah, I fully agree with that assessment of what the mood is like in Kiev and in Ukraine.
Yeah, and before Moscow on Tuesday, the German foreign minister was in Ukraine on Monday. Annalena Baerbock's visit, though, overshadowed by the return of aforementioned former President Petro Poroshenko. He came back to face high treason charges. His successor, Volodymyr Zelensky, accuses him of profiting from coal sales, sharing the benefits with pro-Russian separatists. A judge will rule Wednesday on the prosecution's 31 million euro bail request. Either way, it's quite a sideshow.
We have not won the war, not even a battle, but we have held our position, preventing them from advancing, from destroying Ukraine.
Gulliver Craig, Ukraine is looking for all the friends it can get. This showdown between the current president and his predecessor, is that weakening Kiev's case?
Absolutely, and it probably is, although I can only guess what exactly the details are, a showdown between oligarchs of some kind. I would imagine that it's rivals of Petro Poroshenko, perhaps Igor Kolomoisky, who backed Volodymyr Zelensky in the election in 2019, or some other who's absolutely determined to see him put in jail. I mean, Volodymyr Zelensky himself is a wealthy man and is unhappy also about Petro Poroshenko's treatment of him in the election in 2019, and seems to have some kind of visceral hatred of the former president. But I mean, I think that there must be something behind that, something sort of darker that we don't know about beyond that, which is driving this desire of Volodymyr Zelensky and his entourage to put Petro Poroshenko in jail, to prosecute him, despite the fact that it is so obviously very bad for Ukraine's image. It echoes the former president Viktor Yanukovych's treatment of his sort of predecessor. She was prime minister, not president, but Yulia Tymoshenko, if you remember, she was jailed back in 2012. I mean, all of this looks very bad for Ukraine. It's really very depressing. The fact that it's happening, and also the fact that Petro Poroshenko is trying to milk it for political gain in the way that he is, holding that rally outside the courtroom yesterday in which he was really going completely over the top with comparing Volodymyr Zelensky to Putin and things like that. I mean, it's just a pretty deplorable spectacle. I hope I'm not overstepping my role as correspondent by expressing my opinion so strongly about it, but...
Bill Browder, again, it's going to take a resolve to diffuse this tension. Your thoughts on, again, what seems like quite a spectacle we saw in Kiev on Monday.
It's totally inappropriate and shooting themselves completely in the foot. The Ukrainians need all the help they can get. They need all the Western support they can get for them to have these power struggles flare up in the midst of a potential war is just the most inappropriate thing. It very bad form on Zelensky's part, and again, it's just typical. We see it so many times. The current leader putting the former leaders in prison. It's happening. It happens in all these countries, and the Ukrainians aren't doing themselves any favors by doing this, and perhaps a great harm to their support from the West.
And if you're whispering into Antony Blinken's ear ahead of that Friday sit down in Geneva, what do you say?
I would say go in there and tell Lavrov you get nothing, and we will destroy you economically and in every other way we can if you want to. Invade, do a formal invasion from Russia. There's no other message. None of this, there's no other, we can give you this, we can give you that. We started with the status quo of Russia already having invaded Ukraine by taking Crimea. We can't reward Russia, which is effectively acting as terrorists here, with any type of concessions. And so there should be just, here's the downside. If you want to go forward with it, we'll make sure that downside really hurts you.
Julia Friedrich, you're speaking from a country that was split in two during the Cold War, where 1 million citizens speak Russian. Is there the feeling Germany will rally behind the cause if it does come to a worst-case scenario?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, Germany has traditionally been sort of more of a moderating power also in Europe. And I think it has taken a certain sense of pride and also portraying itself as this bridge between East and West. But we see also in survey trends within Germany, we see that people do perceive Russia as a threat now, not only to Ukraine, but also to European security as a whole. So I do think there would be a rally around the flag. Yes, there would.
Melinda Herring, at this point in time, how far will Joe Biden go when he's still licking his wounds from the withdrawal from Afghanistan?
I don't think he can afford another foreign policy screw-up. That's why it's so important to get Ukraine right. And if I can just drill down and say one thing about the Poroshenko-Zelensky mess, Poroshenko is no angel. I am one of his biggest critics, but he's also not a traitor. So these charges against him, they don't pass the laugh test. And now is really the time for national unity and maturity in Kyiv. And I hope that Biden and his team will convey that to Kyiv.
All right. I want to thank you so much, Melinda, for joining us from Washington. We'll continue to monitor, of course. I want to thank Bill Browder in London, Julia Friedrich in Berlin, Press 24 correspondent Gulliver Cragg in Kiev. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.